The House Transportation Committee will come to order and welcome everybody. We're going to go a little bit out of order and open the public hearing on House Bill 2379. And with that, if you want to come up.
Joining us by phone, Madam Chair, is Professor Margaret Neal from Portland State University, who was involved in a study that this committee actually received last interim. A few members of this committee, I forget, we have a large percentage of our membership of this committee who was not on that committee, so we're going to get a brief run through of that presentation as well.
And welcome, Dr. Neal.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be there.
And I'm going to let Patrick just explain what we're hearing.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2379 imposes an additional tax on cigarettes to the amount of 0.35 cents per cigarette applicable to the distribution of cigarettes on or after January 1st, 2010. Continuously appropriates the money collected from the tax to the Department of Revenue for distribution as specified in the measure and imposes inventory and reporting requirements for distributors of cigarettes and would take effect on the 91st day following adjournment. Signing on.
Thank you, and welcome, and we'll let our technical person introduce herself, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kelsey Wilson, and with the Oregon Transit Association, and I will be the PowerPoint clicker, and then I will have some comments after Dr. Neal's presentation.
Thank you. And so, Dr. Neal, you can go ahead.
All right, Kelsey, could you please advance the slide? What we did in the study that we conducted was we examined mobility options for older adults and people with disabilities and projected to the future, to 2030. Mobility is crucial to the health and well-being of residents. It allows for independence, the ability to seek health care, seek employment, participate in physical and social activities, shop for food, meet other daily needs. So, for older adults and people with disabilities, particularly people who do not drive, public transportation is vital. Next slide, please. There is an urgent need to identify funding strategies, however, for meeting the public transportation needs of these Oregonians, in large part due to projected population increases in their numbers. Next slide. What we did here in this study is we have presented an estimate of the demand for and the cost of transportation for older adults and people with disabilities in Oregon through to the year 2030. We focus on demand response transit. We don't include an estimate of the cost associated with presently unmet travel demand. And let me just make sure that we're all on the defining what we mean by demand response transit. And is the volume okay?
It is. You're breaking up a little bit occasionally, but so far I think it's been okay.
Okay. So demand response transit is transit that dispatches passenger cars, vans, or small buses in response to calls from passengers and transport them to their destinations. Typically, the vehicles don't operate on a fixed route or on a fixed schedule. They may pick up several people at different points before taking them to their respective destinations. And it's considerably more expensive to provide demand response than fixed route. Next slide, please. The research that we did was conducted in response to a note that was attached to the 2007 Oregon legislatively approved budget, which in essence directed DHS and ODOT to work together to investigate new sources of revenue to enhance funding for transportation services for older adults and people with disabilities, both in urban and rural areas. Next slide, please. Back to this issue of unmet demand, although the research has not shown a direct link between unmet travel demand and physical and mental health effects, we do know that previous research has revealed that people who don't drive and people who are in poor health or have disabilities are much more likely than other people to have no social contact on a given day, and there has been a clear link established between social isolation and lower activity levels outside the home, and a variety of negative psychological and health outcomes. So although the research doesn't show any clear or quantitative estimates of unmet travel demand among older people and people with disabilities, we used data from the 2001 National Household Travel Survey to derive a simple estimate of this demand. And basically what we did is we compared the number of trips made by drivers to trips made by non-drivers and found that there was a 26% gap there. So although it's not reasonable or financially feasible for public transportation to meet all of this demand, we did do think that possibly one-third of the unmet demand could be set.
So, Dr. Neal, you've lost us, or you're breaking up, so...
How about now?
You sound good now.
Okay. I think it was because another call was coming in, and I was afraid to send it away.
Okay.
But I send everyone away. And my apologies. Basically, our key findings. This is our main slide here. Both the number and proportion of older adults and people with disabilities will grow fairly dramatically over the next two decades. Number two, there's no increasing or even stable funding source for transportation services for transportation for older adults and people with disabilities, and thus there's going to be a funding gap. Next slide. We conducted a variety of analyses, and I'll share some of those with you. Next slide. This slide of the population trends basically shows that about 22% of Oregon's population now is composed of people with disabilities and or people aged 65 and over. By the year 2030, the number grows 28%. Next slide, please. Let me also say that our demographic projections show that the share of residents in urban and rural areas in Oregon will shift somewhat over time, with slightly more people in urban areas. Basically, next slide, please. Are we on types of services?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So basically, there are two types of public transportation. There's fixed route, demand response. One type of demand response transit is complementary paratransit, which is the transportation that is required by the Americans with Disabilities Act for those individuals who aren't able to use regular fixed route transit. That service that is provided to those individuals only is provided in the areas that do have fixed route, but it does have to be accessible. There does have to be transit accessible to those individuals through demand response, complementary paratransit. One of the problems is that complementary paratransit is driving costs up of fixed route, and I'll explain that in a minute. The other type of transportation services that we have in the state for older adults and people with disabilities is provided by DHS, and it includes both non-emergency medical and non-medical services. Next slide, please. Basically, what this slide shows is that the majority of transportation provided today in Oregon is provided via fixed route in urban areas, 73%. Fixed route in rural areas is only 5% of the rides. Demand response in urban areas is 13% of the rides, and demand response in rural areas is a little bit higher because of the lack of lower availability of fixed route. Demand response is 9%. Next slide, please. The current cost of these services, demand response service costs about $15 to $25 a ride, whereas fixed route services cost $3 to $8 a ride. And the DHS services are even more expensive. The non-emergency medical costs around $42 a ride, and the non-medical rides cost about $25 each. Next slide. In terms of the current funding picture for transportation for older adults and people with disabilities, we have a variety of types. We have, and these are the types for public transportation services, not DHS client services. It's important to note that local sources contribute more than half of the funds used to provide transit for older adults and people with disabilities. But besides that, the most important source of state funding for transit for older adults and people with disabilities is the Special Transportation Fund, which is managed by ODOT's Public Transportation Division. And those funds are used primarily for demand response and rural fixed route. Cigarette tax revenues account for about 45% of the Special Transportation Fund revenues, and some transit providers also receive funding through the Oregon Department of Energy's Business Energy Tax Credits and the Mass Transit Assessment, which is an assessment on state payroll in just 10 areas of the state. Next slide, please. There are two serious contrasting problems depending on whether you're talking about transportation in urban areas or rural areas. In urban areas, there is an increased demand for complementary paratransit, and there's limited ability to control those costs without negatively affecting fixed route service. So let me explain why that is. The ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, requires complementary paratransit service to be offered within 3/4 of a mile of fixed route transit service. Those providers of complementary paratransit cannot limit the number of rides provided to eligible riders by law. And although the agencies work to lower their costs as much as possible through operating efficiencies, we're in the situation right now where several providers have faced the difficult decision of cutting fixed route service, such as to more outlying areas or service on Sundays, in order to control the cost of complementary paratransit. In other words, the only way they see to significantly control the rising costs of the required complementary paratransit is to reduce the availability of fixed route transit. On the other hand, in the rural areas, the problem is not so much with complementary paratransit. The systems there can, in fact, place limitations on the amount of services they provide. But what this means is that through those cost controls, that begins to limit the ability to meet the mobility needs of older adults and people with disabilities. And this is a key problem facing most of the small towns and rural areas of our state. Next slide, please. There are a number of service inadequacies. Basically, they have to do with service beyond 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, service for non-medical trips, medical transportation beyond county boundaries. Next slide, please, on future demands and methods. We used two different methods to project forward based on current levels of service by area and based on population, and then also using our travel survey data to estimate demand for travel by transit. And both of the methods that we used include low and high assumptions. Next slide, please. So in terms of future demand, focusing on demand response transit, if we look just at the increases in population, we expect demand for demand response transit to increase 2.5% to 3% annually. However, urban areas have seen growth that's higher than ridership, even greater than the population growth. And if those trends continue, demand could increase anywhere from 3.8% to 6.5% annually. So the next slide shows the different methods that we used. And rather than go into that, you can just see that no matter which method we use, there's a fairly dramatic increase in demand response that we will experience in the state, whether we use our low estimates or our high estimates. Next slide, please. In terms of fixed route, we estimate the growth in the number of trips taken by older adults and people with disabilities will increase 2% annually in rural areas and about 3.5% in the largest areas. It's important, urban areas. It's important to note, though, that these rates assume no increase in actually the rate of use. These are just based on the population projections. So, for example, if all of a sudden, because of high gas prices, we decide to use the bus more, then these estimates that I'm providing here are going to be an underestimate of future demand for fixed route services. Next slide, please. We do see, because there will be higher rates of growth in the population of older adults, in the urban areas we'll see greater growth rates, and we will see, as a result also of older adult growth, we will see an increase in the use of demand response transit based on the recent trends. The next slide shows, and graphs these again, using our high and our low estimate methods. And we see, again, a dramatic increase in cost over the next 20 years. Next slide, the future costs overall. This table shows both low and high estimates, and I'm going to let you examine it at your leisure because I understand we have limited time. The next slide, future funding sources. Basically, the outlook for current funding sources for special needs transit is not positive. We're expecting cigarette tax revenues will fall 10% or more, and as I said, that was where the STF funding generally comes from. Federal transit funds are dependent on gas tax revenues, and those revenues are decreasing. And local revenue sources are limited. So the next slide, please. This is a graph showing the projected funding gap. Basically, what we find is a potential gap of 10.7 to 25.3 million in the year 2010, which represents about 17 to 31% of the estimated costs. And the gap in the year 2030 could be from 167.3 million to 633.8 million, representing 62 to 80% of the estimated costs. This analysis also highlights the finding that about 60% of the funding for demand response transit for older adults and people with disabilities does come from local sources, including payroll taxes, property taxes, and general funds. Next slide, please. So this slide graphs the low estimate of the gap in funding, and the next slide graphs the gap using the high estimate, very dramatic increases. Future funding sources on the next slide. Just to keep pace with growth and inflation, the cigarette tax is necessary. Currently, it's 2 cents a pack. In 2015, if we increased, it would be necessary to increase it again just to keep pace with growth and inflation from 4.3 to 7.2 cents a pack, and that range is provided because, again, of our low estimate of demand and cost and our high estimate. And then in 2030, the cost, it would be necessary to have tax 37 cents. And again, this doesn't address any needs for new or improved service. And remember, the cigarette tax is only a small portion of the funding package. Next slide, please. So the future, this graphs the various sources of funding, and it shows that even with these increases that we're talking about in the cigarette tax, a funding gap will remain. The cigarette tax represents 10% of the funding for demand response transit for older adults and people with disabilities. The increase is suggested on the earlier slide only serve to keep that share stable, not make up for the full difference between estimated future costs and revenues. What this figure shows is that the projected gap for the year 2015, with increases in the cigarette tax to 4.3% using the low estimate and 7.2% using high, and without the increases, i.e. remaining at 2 cents. This also assumes that some of the other state revenues, such as from ID cards and some off-road fuel taxes, remain constant. Next slide, please. Unfortunately, our analysis of potential new funding sources also is not very positive. Many other states besides Oregon use fuel, vehicle, and sales taxes, but our Constitution doesn't allow vehicle and fuel-related taxes to be used for operating transit. Similarly, other state options here include the cigarette tax, the lottery, and the general fund. We conclude also that then, and to help make up this gap, we do need to explore allowing more flexibility at the local or the regional level to allow local governments to raise transportation revenues locally. Next slide, please. So then the question arises, is it possible to shift trips from demand response to fixed route transit so that we can reduce demand for demand response transit? And the answer is maybe, but it's not likely that a large shift could occur. This is because our transit providers in Oregon already are implementing programs designed to reduce demand for demand response transit. Another factor is that in many rural areas, fixed route transit is not available. A third very important factor is that older adults are increasingly aging in place, that is, living where they have been for a number of years, trying to stay there. And where they are mostly right now is in suburban areas that are not well served by fixed route transit. And then another issue is that there are a number, in reducing demand, is that there are a number of capital improvements, such as sidewalks and benches and shelters, that are especially necessary for the population of older adults and people with disabilities. Next slide, please. We also have a scenario where we don't really know what's going to happen with gasoline, with fuel costs. Future estimates of fuel costs are unreliable. It could be that with the increases in fuel costs that people will use our public transit systems more. The other thing that happens when gas prices raise, and we did see this several months ago, is that there's a reduced likelihood of volunteer programs being able to satisfy the same share of service as today because it's expensive for those volunteer programs to reimburse the volunteers, or volunteers who aren't reimbursed then begin to feel that they can't afford to do that volunteer work any longer. We also are not sure how the changing demographics will affect demand. The research is mixed as to whether people in the baby boomer generation, so in other words, the coming generation of older adults, will be willing to relocate to areas that are better served by transit. And then finally, another issue is that we don't have a lot of information about DHS transportation programs and what those costs will be in the future. But as the next slide shows, the caseload increase is quite likely over the next 10 years. So final slide. This is our contact information if you have any questions, and I would also be happy to try to answer those questions now. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you all today.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Well, I'm not seeing any, and we really appreciate you being able to accommodate us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee. Again, my name is Kelsey Wilson. I'm representing the Oregon Transit Association. And you heard a lot of my talking points I've been using throughout the session from Dr. Neal, so I'll keep my comments limited. I know there's a few others that are hoping to testify today as well. Thank you for the opportunity to support and testify on House Bill 2379, and we'd also, the Oregon Transit Association would like to thank and recognize Chair Beyer for her leadership and dedication on this issue as well. You'll hear from a few of the providers in the audience today who are really feeling this pinch of trying to provide a service for the seniors and people with disabilities in their community and provide the best service that they can, but they're finding that there's just no resources to provide this service. And it's really a problem being felt statewide in the urban and the rural areas. Profile of population is changing, and there's a much higher percentage of seniors in rural communities, although Margaret talked about that they will be migrating to the urban areas as well. As an example, in Lane County, communities, their population of people over 65 is 15% or less. In Florence, the percentage of the population over 65% is, or over age 65 is 38%. So you can see how in the urban and rural areas the population is different. I received a letter from one of my members a couple days ago, and I just wanted to share one of the remarkable paragraphs from it. This is from Frank Thomas from Community Connection of Northeast Oregon in LeGrand. He told me that the fastest growing population they serve is passengers with disabilities. In 1996, they provided 311 rides to this demographic. With a full quarter left to serve in fiscal year 09, they've delivered 6,000 rides to the same passenger class. During the same period of time, rides to seniors grew from around 13,000 to over 26,000. Combined, these populations are consuming more and more of our available resource as they increasingly become underfunded. You also have written testimony from Mary Jo Carpenter of Baker County, who has testified before this committee as well. The Elderly and Handicapped Special Transportation Fund provides funds for services to over a million seniors and people with disabilities each year in Oregon. And the Oregon Department of Transportation distributes these funds to the special transportation providers around the state. And in some cases, for every dollar of special transportation funds, $9 can be leveraged in federal match. So it's not just helping provide those services, it's helping provide the federal match for those services as well. Transportation may seem like a luxury to you and me, but for many of these seniors, it's a means staying in their homes versus going to assisted living, and it's a quality of life issue, and in some cases can be a life or death issue. House Bill 2379 and the Oregon Transit Association respectfully request a 7-cent increase in the cigarette tax revenue for transportation for seniors and people with disabilities. This increase would help share the burden of funding this service and allow transit agencies and rural providers to keep pace with growth in cost and demand. And I've submitted some written testimony, but I will leave it to that for now since most of my comments were previously spoken. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you. Michael Ward, Mark Pangborn, and L.M. Reese. Welcome. Go ahead and get started and get moving.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Michael Ward. I'm the administrator of the Public Transit Division. And I'm going to try to be very brief because we have some actual users of the system and providers. And so I just want to touch on one or two points. Just to be clear, the funding for the Special Transportation Fund is that proverbial three-legged stool. You heard a lot today about the cigarette tax. That's one leg of the stool. The other two legs are the Transportation Operating Fund that contributes to the fund, and the third source of revenue are the fees that DMV collects from the sale of ID cards. Those fee amounts that are above and beyond what it takes DMV to produce and administer the ID card program. So it's those three legs, those three revenue streams that produce about the $18.1 or $18.2 million special transportation fund that we're speaking about here today. The other two points I'd like to make is with House Bill 2379 raises approximately $15 million for the 09-11 biennium and about $22 million for the 11-13 biennium. And we have surveyed our providers, and I provided you on the back page some of the services that those providers would use with this additional revenue. But the key thing I think to make as you read through that is what this increased revenue would really do is allow them to continue to maintain the level of service that they already have in place with some minor increases in new services. And as you heard from Professor Neal, services on weekends, services in the evenings, try to fill in some of those gaps that the current funding for the state program doesn't provide for. So with that, I'd like to just turn it over. If you have any questions, be glad to answer those. If not, I'll turn it over to Mark or this gentleman.
I know about anybody else. I just wanted to know if you could kind of give us an idea of the trend on the ID cards.
Chair Beyer, yes, the trend on the sale of ID cards has been going down as a result of about three things. The long-term trend for the ID card revenue has been a downward slope. Some years ago, DMV went from a four-year to an eight-year cycle. That had an impact. More recently, in February of 2008, DMV firmed up, tightened up their identity requirements to obtain an ID card. We saw an immediate 30% decrease in the number of ID cards that DMV was issuing. That number has remained pretty stable through the last year and reflects just a significant drop in the number of ID cards and probably driver's licenses, but I'm not real familiar with driver's licenses, but certainly on the ID card side. The other factor that I alluded to was that the monies that go to public transit is really the net amount from revenue. So once DMV has withdrawn or taken off the amount that it costs them to administer the program, public transit gets that money. It's typically about $3.5 million. But DMV has just looked at and recalculated their costs. Those costs, of course, have risen. The current figure that they were using was calculated back in 2002. So now we have a new number, a new cost figure that will be implemented July 1 of 2009. Will have a negative effect on the amount of money left over for public transit. So all of those factors have combined to make the ID card leg of the stool less and less sustainable for us.
Thank you. Representative Call.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just, Mr. Ward, maybe you have the answer to this. I hope that you do. The reauthorization and expansion of SCHIP at the federal level was predicated on an enormous increase of tobacco tax at that level, which means we're going to see a drop-off in revenue, actual revenue at our level for people who don't buy cigarettes, which some of this is a good thing. I'm wondering, how much do you know how much of this 6 cents is actually going to go to fill the shortfall that's going to be the result of the new federal tax? And if not, do you know if there's anybody looking into that right now?
Chair Beyer, Representative Call, I do not know the answer to that, and be glad to look into it and get an answer back to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, Mr. Pangborn or Mr. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Mark Pangborn. I'm the general manager of Lane Transit District as well as the president of the Oregon Transit Association, so I'll try to wear two hats here as I speak. Dr. Neal really explained kind of the concern or issues with Americans with Disabilities Act. And but I think the important point on that is that it really are, there are two populations here. There's the urban population that is served by systems with fixed route, and they have one set of problems, very, very significant, because as the increased costs of the dial-a-ride service, the demand response service, goes up, it's pulling away resources from those fixed route systems out there in the community. And I will tell you, the vast majority of seniors and disabled in our community in Eugene Springfield area actually ride the fixed route system. They're not on the dial-a-ride system. That it's a very, that service is very limited. Now, it's quite expensive. Dr. Neal was correct. Our costs are about $25 for a ride for the ride source, and about $3 if they're on the system. So we work very, very hard to, with people who have disabilities, who may be elderly and may not be concerned about riding the system, to use it because it's much more efficient and actually gives them a better service. It's more mobility, and more opportunities. It has more schedules to go on. Nonetheless, it is, we're having to cut service. This year, we were going to projected to cut 15% of our service because of the loss, local loss of payroll tax. And there were a number of elderly and disabled persons who were going to lose service. Now, we were rescued by the stimulus package. We're going to use some of that money to avoid it, but that's a one-year solution. We'll be right back at the problem in a year from now, and so we're concerned. But that's on the urban side. On the rural side, you have people who can't get into critical services like food and medical, things of that sort, because they're isolated out in the community, have no option even on fixed route. So the issue is very, very urgent throughout the state, regardless of the size of the community or the density of that community. We're spending now about $3 million a year for the dial-a-ride service, what we call Ride Source. Now, if you may have this handout in front of you. It has this little chart. If you look on that, that red line signifies the state funding that we're currently receiving for, they have it? Yeah, you got it? Yes, you got it. The red line is what we've been receiving since before 2001 in terms of the monies you were talking about, the cigarette tax, the ID card, and the lawnmower fees. You can see back in 2001, it paid for almost all of the costs of that service. Now we're out here in the 2008-2009, and we're actually putting in almost a little over $2 million a year into that service, about $2 million. So, and it's going to, as Dr. Neal pointed out, that's going to rise. So what is being proposed with this bill would pick up about one-third of the cost. It would bring us back up, but it would never get us back to where we were back in 2000 in terms of the level of state funding for the cost of the program. So I urge you to give serious consideration to the bill. I know there's a nexus problem. Why a cigarette tax? But as Dr. Neal pointed out, there aren't many other options, and this is where we are now. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Schaffner?
Thank you. No matter what we do, we're not going to be able to sustain this. We're not. This trend is impossible to sustain, period, no matter what we do, unless we radically change how we spend money on transportation in the state, which may be something we look at in the future. But I support a modest increase in the cigarette tax. I'm not sure I'm 100% buying 7 cents a pack. But I will tell you this. When it comes down to choosing between bicycle trails and transporting the disabled and the elderly in Lane County and around the rest of the state, I know exactly which one I'm going to choose. So we have some hard decisions to make in this building, but I think I know where I'm going.
Thank you. Seeing it, no more questions there. So, Mr. Reese.
Chair Breyer and members of the community, my name's L.M. Reese. And becoming a senior citizen myself, I do know the importance of being able to get around and take care of your own business, even if it's just going to buy a shirt or for our lady buying a dress or going to the grocery store and buying groceries. I like to pick out my own food. Some of our people in the Eugene area are not able to cross the street and go step on a bus. But with the ride source situation, they come to the door and pick you up. And that enables those people to take care of their own business. And without increase from the cigarette tax, there's no room to increase the demand for this type of service. I'm the chair of the Accessible Transportation Committee for Lane Transit. And because the funds are limited, we must tell some people who ask for a ride on the special transportation that you don't qualify. Some of these people eventually learn how to ride the bus. Other people don't. They have to rely on friends or relatives or stay in their homes and eventually end up in assisted living or nursing homes. Wouldn't it be better to provide special transportation to everyone who needs it? It is, and so they can stay in their homes while also being able to go to medical appointments and go shopping. And if it wasn't for the special transportation van that I came up today in, I wouldn't be here speaking to you. And I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, I really appreciate you coming up today and your testimony. I'm going to call Julie Wilkie, Mary Sue Jepson, and then Nicole Palmateer Armstrong. Go ahead.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Julie Wilkie, and I'm with Ride Connection in Portland, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you today why House Bill 2379 is so important to community members in Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas County. Last time I was here, I shared with you a little bit about what Ride Connection does, what our mission is, our values, and how we assist older adults and people with disabilities to maintain their independence in the Portland area. Today, I would like to share with you our current funding picture and what we will be able to accomplish with the passing of House Bill 2379. The limitations of funding and really what it means to us is the special transportation funds are declining. We use them for operations. We contract with community-based providers to provide direct service to older adults and people with disabilities in our community. The current allocation, which includes the cigarette tax, as it was mentioned, is no longer able to sufficiently supply enough funds for operating at our current level. Ride Connection and TriMet in the last fiscal year and in this fiscal year, we had to find funds in order to fill the gap, and that was really something that we are not able to continue to do. It was about a 9% decrease that we had in formula funds. This, coupled with a reduction in funding for our capital purchases also, has really created a situation that is important for us to figure out so that we can meet the demands of our community members. What this does is it directly affects the number of rides that we can provide. So in addition to that, with additional funds, we would be able to look at our hours and days of operation. That was something that was mentioned. We currently are at Monday through Friday, 8 to 4 p.m., so we're not able to provide evening or weekend service. It also would assist us with ride requests, because that is really affected by our limited funding. Not all of our rides are guaranteed, and we try and be as efficient as possible. So therefore, customers that are requesting rides need to contact us at least 4 days prior to their trip and are not notified until 48 hours before their ride if we have found a volunteer driver in order to provide that ride. And that can create some anxiety and uncertainty, and it also is difficult to get a ride on a short-term basis for our our customers. There also, as was mentioned in Dr. Neal's presentation, a growing demand for our service. So just in this last fiscal year, if we compare it to previous fiscal years, we have seen an increase in ride requests. We've had about 800 additional customers that have requested rides. And also we've seen increase in the number of rides that we can provide. So more customers are requesting more types of service. How does this impact our riders, our customers, and our community members? Last time I was here, Evelyn testified about what our service means to her. She talked about the health benefits that were associated with the interaction that she was able to participate in her community, as well as her volunteer activities benefit our community as a whole, and her ability to remain independent. I would like to introduce Mary Sue Jepson, and she is going to share her story about Ride Connection and what the service does for her. But what I would like to just finish in saying in my testimony is that with additional funds, we would be able to keep our service partners whole. We would be able to move towards guaranteeing rides, providing rides on a shorter notice. We could potentially extend our service hours, but most importantly, be able to meet the growing need of our community members and our population. So we support House Bill 2379, and when we'd hope that you would be able to support it too. And I'd like to introduce Mary Sue Jepson.
Thank you.
Just talking to her. I'm Mary Sue Jepson. I'm legally blind. I'm 67, and I volunteer at the Gresham Senior Center, and it just makes, my sister says I'm a lot better for my mind when I'm doing something than when I'm staying home. And it's kind of like Evelyn, it's interacting with people, and I do the survey and the salt and pepper shakers, and it just really helps me, my morale, and the service has been real good. I can come to the senior center even when the weather is unfavorable, and I really have a lot to say. It's really good, and I just would be kind of hard without it. It'd be hard. I could adjust, but it sure makes it a lot easier to have the ride connection when you come to the senior center. And
thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Pommetier Armstrong. I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging. We'd like to express our strong support for House Bill 2379 and the increasing in mobility for our seniors and people with disabilities. We'd like to thank Representative Beyer for your continued support of this particular issue. Oregon is so well known for our system of home and community-based care, but the interesting thing about home and community-based care is that you still have to be able to move about in your community in order for it to work. Transportation is a very integral part of that, and we see that every day when we are working with the clients who come through our doors while we're putting together a case management plan. We're not just looking at how to live in their home, but how are they going to get groceries? Are they still able to pick up medications, go to doctor's appointments? And the longer somebody can do that, the longer they're able to stay independent, stay in their home, within their community, be able to use the natural supports that they have, and that's a significant thing. I know in the morning I don't think twice about when I need to go pick up something or when I need to go to the doctor, but if I had to think about that 4 days in advance every single time I had to do that, it would change my life. I think it would change everybody's life. We work really closely with transportation, particularly in the rural areas of the state. Our smaller area agencies on aging often serve as coordinator for transportation. And we've heard quite a bit in the last 6 to 8 months about the increased demand for transportation services because people are certainly facing a different economic reality. And in the rural areas, there just aren't the options, and there's the geographic challenges. There's a lot more miles to travel, and you need some sort of assistance to do that. Otherwise, you're going to have to look at leaving your home or your community. So we support this bill. We hope that it continues to move forward in the process, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
And I have three more people, and I'm just going to bring you all up together. You could call this probably the odd couple, but Rob Johnson, Olivia Clark, and John Charles. Go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rob Johnson with the Oregon Healthcare Association, appearing before you today in my capacity as a member of the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disabilities. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2379, as it is one of the six key priority areas that the campaign has identified that we will work toward in the 2009 session and beyond. The campaign was formed after the 2007 session when we got some feedback from legislators, all of your colleagues, that advocates for senior and disability programs operated in a very fragmented way. A lot of complicated programs, and we all sort of had our niche, but that there was some opportunity to coordinate to make it easier not only on all of the legislators, but also on ourselves. To make a better case for our issues. So we began to meet in September of 2007 to talk about what were the major priority areas that were important to all of us. And from that prioritization process, we came up with a list of six, one of which being housing and transportation services for vulnerable Oregonians. And the reason that we prioritized this particular issue is a direct result of the fact that it connects vulnerable Oregonians to the needed services in their communities that they are attempting to access every day, many of those services that a lot of us are fighting to maintain this session and beyond. As Dr. Neal said in her testimony, I think we look at this as a component of mental and emotional well-being for vulnerable Oregonians because we know how damaging isolation can be to these populations. And I think we would consider this a small investment with a very big payoff for vulnerable populations in Oregon. And in the dire economy in which we are currently operating, I think we're all looking to make strategic investments with the limited state resources that we have, and I think we would consider this a very strategic investment. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony, except to say that we wanted to thank Representative Beyer for championing this issue and bringing it before the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Olivia?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Olivia Clark, representing TriMet, and I will be very, very brief since I've got given you lots of paper. I'll just want to make a couple of points. You've heard a lot of testimony about the need, the lifeline service that this represents. I just wanted to say, add to the record, that we wouldn't be here today if we weren't doing everything that we could to reduce the demand for this service. We have over 100 million rides on fixed route in the metropolitan area. 10% of those are already the elderly and disabled. We have over a million demand response rides, which is about $30 million in our budget. You saw the math from the professor's presentation. But I just want to make sure that you know that we're doing everything we can to reduce that demand by removing environmental barriers, working with our local partners, 24 cities in the metropolitan area, to put in sidewalks where we need sidewalks to get people to the bus stop, making sure the bus stop is accessible, putting automated stop announcements on the buses for people who have visual problems. We're doing all those kinds of things. At the same time, we're training people to ride fixed route. We provide our older vehicles to nonprofits to use them to do the same kind of thing. We're also creating this year an assessment center, asking people who want the service to come in and actually receive an assessment to find out what is the service that they actually need and are there opportunities for them to use fixed route for some trips. And about, I think, 70% of our trips are medically related, so there really is a nexus between this and the cigarette tax. So with that, I'll just close and thank you, Chair Beyer, for your strong support for our needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schaffner.
Thank you. Just to clarify something I said earlier, we can't use any potential bike money for this because we can't use gas tax for this. But that wasn't what I want to talk about. Olivia, I know you're doing a great job up there, Portland and TriMet. I have a good friend of mine that I worked in union with for years, and his wife is blind, and they moved from Portland to Indianapolis for several years and then moved back to Oregon. And she could not believe. They live just off Powell Boulevard. She's 100% blind, has a seeing eye dog, would walk down the street, cross Powell Boulevard at a signal, get on a bus and transfer at 39th, and I can't remember where she went after that, but she worked downtown somewhere. They moved to Indianapolis, and she said, it's just horrible. The streets, the sidewalks, it's a tripping hazard compared to Portland and what we do in TriMet. So I commend you in what you're doing there. That being said, these trends are totally unsustainable. I really don't know what to do. We're not going to be able to raise enough money to provide this service, so I'm just venting my frustration and fear, Madam Chair. But keep up the good work.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Charles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit research center in Portland. Yeah. And I don't doubt that there are many, many people who benefit from these services and need these services, but I would like to raise a couple policy concerns. One is, this is the classic moral hazard problem. There are many cigarette tax proposals in this building, and people are in favor of them for one of two reasons. Either they're in favor to raise the cost to suppress smoking, in which case they would like to suppress smoking to zero, and therefore tax revenue to zero, or they're in favor of these cigarette tax proposals to raise revenue. Now, you can be in favor of one or the other of those. You cannot be in favor of both simultaneously. They're mutually exclusive. So if you pass this bill, then what you're saying is your goal is that you hope people buy lots of cigarettes because you need the revenue. Mm-hmm. Now, that's what you want to say at your next town hall, that you're in favor of more people smoking. That's fine. I sort of doubt that that's what you want to say. But this sort of points to the largest growing addiction problem in the state, which is legislative addiction to drinking, smoking, and gambling revenues for general purpose programs. That's a big problem, I think. You need to really consider how you want to fund these programs. Second, flowing from that, is it's simply not fair to pick on what is I view as a persecuted minority of cigarette smokers who are generally not here to defend themselves for purposes, city and county general funds and this type of programs that have nothing to do with cigarettes. Now, I don't smoke. Nobody who works for me smokes. I don't have a vested interest exactly in this. It just bothers me that people think cigarette smokers are some kind of ATM machine. My third point really flows from what Representative Schaffler has said twice now. This whole system is broken. It's not sustainable. If these services are worth doing, and I think they are worth doing, I think then they should be paid for out of a more progressive source, such as the general fund. If not, then I think you have an omnibus transportation bill in your committee. You've taken hearings on it. I think something much bigger, more fundamental needs to happen to solve this problem, and that might be the venue, and I'd be happy to help do that. But to continue to incrementally raise cigarette taxes for things that have nothing to do with a smoking cessation or public health, among other things, is just going to actually drive total revenues down anyway due to black market sales and other reasons inherent in high excise taxes. So I think at some point we need to take a completely different approach than is in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler, did I see your hand?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for your indulgence. I appreciate it. I'm serious about that. You're very patient with me, Madam Chair. You know, we tax smoking, drinking, gambling. We ought to throw cussing in there, and my tax bill will go up quite a bit. But that's one progressive tax increase I can imagine. Sir, my question to you is, what specific tax increases that are politically viable in this state are you and your good institute in support of? Across the board, not just this issue.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, as I've testified, at least in this committee, I'm in favor of a couple things that many people don't want to support, but I've said...
Politically viable, sir, not anything that can pass a referendum. I'm interested in hearing what you support that would.
No, I think some form of a mileage-based user fee is, and congestion pricing is viable. As far as general taxation, you know, what's politically viable? I don't know.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of hitting on your point with the gambling, drinking, and cigarette taxes, I think something we're looking at doing here by raising that as much as we're looking at is actually decreasing the amount of cigarettes being purchased in the state of Oregon, and I think we'll be changing people's buying habits. And I think it's kind of a shame that we put bicycles before seniors. How come we don't have 1% set aside for seniors? And I don't know if you think that would be a more viable way to do this out of the ODOT's general fund rather than 1% for bikes, 1% for seniors?
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, as a policy matter, I'm generally not in favor of fixed percentages because that's independent of the of an assessment of the need. But your point is well taken. Why one, not the other? I don't know. That's a legislative policy decision.
Thank you. And just in response a little bit to what you're saying, I do think in this building we are a little schizophrenic in how we do things. I will agree that lowering the amount of people that buy cigarettes and smoke them is ideal. Maybe that would lower the health care costs we have in this state and maybe allow a little more money available to help fund these programs for seniors. So I don't see a negative, and I really don't see them in conflict. I think that one way or another we'll save money at the state level. So with that, thank you, and I appreciate everybody who came and testified on House Bill 2379, and I'm going to close the public hearing. And I'm going to go ahead, we're looking at the number of people, I'm going to go ahead and open House Bill 2043, and we'll see who all is signed up. I assume Art is. Yeah. Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, House Bill 2043, eliminates the requirement that county ordinances establishing a registration fee for vehicles be approved by voters. The measure also adds low-speed vehicles and racing activity vehicles to the list of vehicles that may not be charged additional county registration fees.
Thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and Okay. Call up Art Schlack, Lynn Peterson, and Philip Kennedy Wong.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Art Schlock, and I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And we're here today to talk about something that there's been an ongoing discussion with the legislature and I'll say local government, and that is providing opportunities for units of local government sometimes to help themselves. But to help ourselves, we need tools and we need opportunities to help ourselves. House Bill 2043 is a proposal that would help counties potentially help themselves. And what it does, and maybe some of you have heard me speak to the question of double jeopardy as it comes to the question of a local vehicle registration fee. Current statute provides that a county must go to a vote of the people within its county if it wishes to entertain the adoption of an ordinance that would establish a local vehicle registration fee. Then the county would go out and adopt the ordinance. Well, that ordinance then could also be referred to the people for on referral for another vote. So there's like two bites of the apple, if you will. So that's what this bill intends to do. It removes the first vote at this point that the counties would have to take. I would also note, however, that there are some counties that, because of their home rule charter, still would have to do that. But this, again, is option. optional. It's not that for sure that a county would establish a local vehicle registration fee, but again, it would be an option. Counties, as you know, are responsible for over 26,000 miles of highway. And in recent years, the county road system has been greatly distressed because of the reduction in revenue from the state. And also, you've heard over the last couple of years about secure rural schools and the fact that the counties, while we've got a little bit of a reprieve, if you will, at the federal level, the federal forest monies are on a downhill projection, and counties will lose in the neighborhood of $100 million a year within the next couple of years at this point. So despite local efforts at this point, you know, we still have problems dealing with maintenance and preservation of the local road system. And I would note that this bill, as it currently is constituted, would benefit both cities and counties, since state law requires counties to share a local vehicle registration fee, the revenues from those fees with cities through an established formula within statute, or based on another sharing of those revenues that would be mutually agreed upon. House Bill 2043 would allow a county the flexibility to decide whether to enact local ordinances without referring that proposal to a vote initially. We think that this is a good public policy. County commissioners are very responsible. They also work well with the cities within their jurisdiction, and it would take a combined effort if a county was to look at the establishment of a local vehicle registration fee. Certainly, some of you may have in mind, well, what if the state raises a fee? Well, that's certainly a possibility. That's part of the package that you have before you for consideration. But I would just note, again, this is an option. This is an option that a county would look at. It certainly has to take a look at both the implications at the state level and also the local level. There may be only a handful of counties that will look at this, but still, it is extremely important to help maintain, preserve, and address questions of congestion within the counties around the state. And with that, Chair Peterson from Clackamas County.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for having me here today. I just wanted to build on some of Art's comments, and I know I've been here talking to you about this before. Some of you remember that we worked very hard on this issue last year. One of the things that I think that you need to really think about in terms of the importance of this is no matter what the state package looks like for a transportation funding bill, the local level needs to be able to match you most of the time, especially when we're talking about state money. So at the moment, we don't have the monies to do the match. And so in order for us to have a match, we need to have those revenue sources in order to do that. And that's true with the federal as well. If we were to get money from the feds, there's a match that's required. And right now, we sometimes can't match the match, or we can't come up with the money to do that. So I think you really need to think about how transportation money stacks up and is leveraging other transportation money. And right now at the local level, we can't do that. But I think the other part that's really important is that the revenues that a county would raise wouldn't be shared locally with their cities, as Art mentioned. But what we have found in Clackamas County is that we cannot be successful unless we have a complete agreement from all our cities anyway. So it's really important. Some have referred to the spider web. The spider web, to me, is insignificant in terms of we can only have success if our cities agree in the long run. So to us, it's more important to actually have the ability to do this than it is to deal with a spider web. The other really important point is that right now we don't have any tools available to us that would allow us to go beyond just the state and federal gas tax. And we have cities that even with a state package coming through, we'll still not be able to do any kind of Main Street improvements, any large capital projects. They've been holding off on them, whether you're Malala downtown or you're Tigard and you're looking at redoing your downtown and expanding it along 99W. There is no local match to be able to do that. So just keep in mind that these are this type of money would leverage the locals to actually be able to carry out their redevelopment plans for not only their existing main streets and industrial employment sites, but also developing areas like Damascus. So just keep in mind the breadth of what we're talking about here. We can't get at the local needs with the state money alone. So that's, I'll just leave it at that because that's really the important part that I want to impart on to you. Thanks.
Okay. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, for record, Phil Kennedy Wong, Multnomah County. I wanted to actually touch upon what Chair Peterson was talking about. She's absolutely right. In terms of projects within transportation projects within counties where counties are looking for federal funds, you know, the big challenge for us is to get that local match, and certainly this bill would provide one of those options for us to consider as we try to build that local match. And as many of you know, we have a bridge that's been rated very, very low in terms of federal safety, the Selwood Bridge. And to be quite honest, it's something that's been a struggle for our chair, Ted Wheeler, who has worked very closely on a regional level through JPAC in order to help develop local funds for that match. And I want to be clear to you that for Multnomah County, this is really about local flexibility, the ability to find a local solution to local transportation needs, but obviously in partnership with the state and our partners on the regional level. And just so you know, we are participating both on a statewide level and on the regional level through the JPAC table in terms of developing a regional transportation funding plan, but also working together on a state level to help shape the transportation package, which we are looking forward to seeing from this committee. So with that, I appreciate your support of this bill and would be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. I have Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Philip, I'm wondering about the Selwood Bridge. It's my understanding that this bill here doesn't do anything about the spider web. So even if this was intact, Chair Wheeler is going to have to go out to Troutdale, where he lost. He's going to have to go to Maywood Park, which is a city of 1 square mile that incorporated itself simply to oppose I-205. He's going to have to travel into Chair Peterson's district to go to a Lake Oswego City Council meeting, which isn't located, with the city hall of which is not even located inside Multnomah County, to ask permission of that city council, a lot of whom don't live within Multnomah County, so that he can then go back to his board and have a vote to raise a registration fee, which under this bill, that then would be enacted. But to me, I feel like this bill doesn't get us the Selwood Bridge. Even if Multnomah County chooses to try to institute a registration fee, it has an insurmountable hurdle to try to surpass here. So maybe you can tell me how this bill gets us there, because I'm not seeing it.
Madam Chair, Representative Call, let me provide a quick response, and I think Chair Peterson wants to respond as well. You're absolutely right. There is this requirement that has Multnomah County needing to get an IGA signed by the 6 cities within our county and other jurisdictions within the metropolitan area in order to put a county vehicle registration fee just for Multnomah County on a local ballot. And as some of you have followed that, that was a very frustrating process for our chair. With that said, we have been working in conjunction with our partners through JPAC, and one of the things that we agreed to do is to put off this discussion of the spider web until after the legislative session, with the goal that after the session that we would have in place some of these tools, and this is one of those tools, for the region to consider and for the region to go out together to develop a regional funding source. So I don't know if that quite answers your question, but let me turn it over to Chair Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Call, I think you've noted one thing, and we've focused on it, with that which is the Selwood Bridge. But this type of flexibility helps the entire state with all 36 counties, and it's really, really important to think of it that way. But we bring this up because of the spider web issue. And so you're correct in highlighting it. But I think lessons learned that the region learned from Multnomah County's good work to go out and have this discussion is that you need to have something on the table for all of your partners. And it's something that Clackamas County certainly has learned with the successful library measure, is that we need to be able to show every single one of the participating jurisdictions that there is a good reason for them to participate in this. And so one of the things we've been talking about at the region is how do we, Clackamas and Multnomah, help fund a Selwood, but then have the money to be able to work with each of our cities on their downtown redevelopments. So it's not just one project. And that's the most important thing here, is that this type of thing needs to be enacted in order to get at the local level, neighborhood level, because the state transportation package you'll be looking at, the majority of it we will not see at the neighborhood level. This is the only way to get at some of those regionally significant but small projects in downtowns in order to do the redevelopment that we're looking at needing to do.
Chair Byer, Representative Call, let me just add the fact that for when a county looks at or enacts a vehicle registration fee, 40% of the revenue that it collected must be shared with the cities. So there is some local funds that come back to the cities within the jurisdiction, you can, or unless otherwise agreed to. The otherwise agreed to might be the situation where for the first couple of years the revenue go to a particular project or something. But again, everybody's got to agree to this. But the first step, I would submit to you, the first step is to remove the double jeopardy issue here, so that responsible county commissioners can look at their options, talk to their colleagues in the cities, and come up with a plan so that they can address vital infrastructure needs.
Representative Boone. Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think I've left the room, but I have not heard anybody talk about what strikes me as the main issue in this bill, and that is, it says, counties already have the authority to collect fees for vehicles registered to drivers who reside in the county. Under current law, an ordinance to establish a county vehicle registration fee must be submitted to the voters for their approval. And it sounds like this bill is removing that provision. And so I guess I have to, you can already do it, but you don't want it to go to the voters. I guess I have to ask why.
Chair Byer, Representative Boone, let me see if I can't make it maybe a little bit clearer. A county, when it wants to entertain the adoption of an ordinance, before they've adopted the ordinance, they have to go right now to a vote within countywide, and at that point, the voters can say yes or no. Let's assume at this point that the voters say yes, and so the county goes forth, adopts an ordinance, and then somebody's still unhappy with that ordinance. They can take out a petition and have that ordinance then referred for a second vote. What we're asking for here is to allow the county to adopt an ordinance similar to a city that adopts a gas tax. A city can go adopt a gas tax by ordinance, and it can be referred, and sometimes is. But at this point, the city doesn't have to go to a vote of the people within the city and ask them, may we put this on, you know, maybe we entertain an ordinance. And so that's what we're trying to do. One bite of the apple through a referendum on a bill, but rather than two bites of the apple.
Follow it. Having been a county commissioner, maybe it was a long time ago and I've forgotten all those little things, but I am not aware of, is that county by county, or is every ordinance required to be sent to the voters? I don't recall
it
that.
It is unique for counties dealing with vehicle registration fees.
Okay.
And the state, you don't have to, you know, the state can do a vehicle registration fee. You do it. It could be referred. But you don't ask the people of the state of Oregon before you pass the bill, can I pass a bill as the legislative body? That's not required. The cities with a gas tax can, again, as I said, pass a gas tax. It can be referred, which is the American way. I mean, you know, so that's all we're asking for, in a way, is to be treated equally to the state as a unit of government and to the cities as a unit of government. Just treat us the same.
Thank you. And I guess I just, you know, was a little dismayed at a statement that you, Commissioner Peterson, made about the state state transportation package that we would pass isn't going to get down to that local level. And if I honestly thought that whatever we were doing here was not going to get to that local level, I'd have packed it in a long time ago. So I do want to say I don't think that's true, and I'm sorry.
Since it's not true. On capital, it is.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and call up Bob
Chair
Russell.
Barr. Yes. Chair Barr, I would be remiss if I at least, and excuse me for interrupting, I would be remiss if I didn't at least mention the fact that this measure, 2043, is in the job and jobs bill that it's also being considered, and that we submitted this, AOC submitted this as a standalone, because at the time we weren't sure that the proposal would be in House Bill within the large funding package. So we appreciate the fact that you've heard this bill as a standalone so that we have some options.
Thank you
for that.
You're welcome. All right. With that, I'm going to call Bob Russell, Craig Campbell, and if Jim Walsh has entered the room.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA. I'm going to apologize in advance as I have to rush off to another meeting as soon as I'm done testifying. So I have no disrespect to the other members of the panel. I would love to hear what they have to say. I'm here in opposition to House Bill 2043, and it might be a little bit different than you're used to hearing around tax policy. AAA is a strong adherent to the concept of cost responsibility in taxation. That provision is in our Constitution. It also is something that's studied every 2 years in Oregon's cost responsibility allocation study. Essentially, what that says is any given tax that's applied on cars has a certain percentage that also must be taxed on trucks to represent the fair share between the two of them. Local registration fees, by their nature, either are exclusively applied to automobiles or disproportionately applied to automobiles because they cannot apply to most of the trucking that ends up going through a particular jurisdiction. And as a result, automobiles always take a larger share of the taxation from that registration fees than is their cost responsible share under that study. The way AAA generally looks at that is that if there is an opportunity for the public to vote on that, we take them as a proxy for our members in indicating that they think an exception to cost responsibility is warranted. So if a county wanted to increase a registration fee, as long as the public goes ahead and votes on it and says, yeah, we think in this case the cost responsibility exception is warranted, then we're happy with that. So the way the statute currently is presented works very well for us. I don't in any way want to indicate that my testimony is a reflection upon the use of these tax monies at the local level. They do a very good job. They take care of a lot of roads that our members work on, and we applaud them for the hard work that they do. But especially during difficult economic times when it sometimes seems a necessity to divert from good tax policy in the name of dealing with very difficult crisis, that's the time that our voice needs to be even stronger, because when the crisis is abated, then you're left with bad tax policy. And so as a result, we're opposed to this bill, and in fact have opposition to this provision within the larger tax package as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and we also have some concerns about this bill. Certainly, we have concerns about the cost responsibility aspects of it, as Craig was talking about, there is really no way to balance the books between cars and trucks at the county level with a local registration fee. I mean, there's a lot of complexities to the truck tax system that makes that the case, but there's also some exemptions for trucks from this whole statute that are prorated and those that are over 26,000 pounds. But what happens is that if this were to happen at the county level, then cars would be paying more than their fair share, and that sort of argument is going to spill over at the state level with the state cost allocation study, and that just complicates things a lot. Some of you remember those days when AAA and OTA didn't get along so well, and that was not good for the state's transportation policy. So we support AAA and their concerns about cost allocation. But I think there's another aspect of this that is causing us a lot of concern. Some of our tax instruments in the transportation area are becoming inelastic because they're becoming so expensive. And one of the things that we talked about last session with Senate Bill 566 was sort of separating the tax instruments and the levels of government. In other words, reserving some tax instruments for use by the state and others by local government. And that way there would be money for everybody, and it wouldn't be putting pressure from local governments on the instruments used for the state and vice versa. You may recall that before the session, there was some discussion by the city of Portland about passing a local gas tax. And there was lots of discussion about the implications of that for us passing a transportation funding package this session. Sam Adams agreed to withdraw his proposal to do a City of Portland gas tax to give you folks an opportunity to do a statewide tax to benefit everybody. That's the dynamic that concerns us. If Portland, in fact, had have passed a significant gas tax before session, it would be very, very difficult for us to get a transportation funding package out of this legislature. So we would like to separate those tax instruments so that they're used by different layers of government. Historically, gas taxes and registration fees are used by the state, but then the revenues are split with local government, with split with cities and counties. The current proposal in the JTA is for a 50-50 split. So there's significant amounts of that revenue that does go down to the local level, and we certainly support that and think that they do a good job. There's also another of other tax instruments that locals have available to them that, from our perspective, it would be best for the state to keep their fingers out of those pies, like property taxes, system development charges, tax increment financing, street maintenance fees, which take a variety of different kind of forms. Medford has a 50-cent per month tax on the water bill that goes for streets, for example. There was one proposed in Portland that was based on the number of trips generated by a property. There have been others that have been proposed based on parking spaces, those kinds of things, and tolling. You have a bill that you'll be looking at later this session that will clarify our current policy to make sure that Multnomah County can toll the bridges over the Willamette if they so choose. So there are different tax instruments that are available at different levels of government, and we think that that's appropriate, and we would prefer that this tax instrument be utilized primarily by the state. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer and committee members, Jim Wills here for Oregon Cattlemen and Oregon State Grange. And, you know, we would certainly oppose this, but in an effort to try to be part of the solution for transportation and even for our counties, but we think this is the wrong mechanism. And we'd like to keep it like Mr. Russell was talking about, certainly at the state level. We'd like to allow the electorate to vote on this. But there's 36 reasons, you know, that we have for not liking this. And we think the imbalance, because even in farming, yes, we have exemptions for farm vehicles, but we're talking about everything that brings the grain, the products, and the transportation intrastate and interstate for cattle today, because we don't have processing throughout the state like we'd like to have it, like should be here in this state. Our cattle are trucked hundreds and hundreds of miles, and all those trucks have to stand even with their destination. If they were to, a county was to increase wherever their destination point was, that county, they could really hurt that industry. And so we need to keep this statewide, and I know the Oregon State Grange feels the same way on registration fees. They'd much rather have the people vote on this. And let's not create imbalance that is going to cause a real problem. Let's try to be, and we want to be, part of the solution, but we don't think this package is.
Thank you. Representative Shoffman.
Thank you. I think the Selwood Bridge, both counties should just slap a toll on that bridge right now to pay for it. I have a constituent. They own some gas stations and fuel distribution, and they cannot use that bridge anymore. And their trucks and drivers got to drive around at great cost. And I imagine whatever the toll is would probably be less than the cost of the fuel, the wear on their vehicles, and the wages they're paying for that truck to drive around that bridge. And if people want to use something in this state, I think tolls on a bridge, especially for new capacity, is a perfect way to pay for something new. And that's what I think we should do. And if people don't like it, they can come down here and explain how they think they'd rather pay for it. But I think what we got here is a whole bunch of people in this state that want a bunch of stuff, but they just don't want to pay for it. That's really what it boils down to. That's all I want to say, Madam
Chair. Thank you. Representative Call.
And I'd just like to echo Representative Shoffler's point on that. I do hope that the bill you talked about that's going to hopefully clarify the law and allow Multnomah County to levy tolls on its bridges it will pass this session, and that we can actually do that, because right now Multnomah County is precluded by Oregon state law from tolling that bridge to pay for its repairs. So I agree with you completely, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. We appreciate it. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2043 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2042. And hopefully we'll get through everybody, but I am going to call the county people up first, because they aren't in the building all the time. So we'll get them, and if we have to, we can carry it over for all you building regulars. Yes, Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2042 stipulates that the right and privilege to construct, maintain, and operate utility lines, fixtures, and facilities along public roads free of charge does not extend to public roads under county jurisdiction.
Okay. Art Schlack, Cam Gilmore, and I'm not having much luck reading the next names. Bill Hogan?
Morgan.
Sorry. And Bill, okay. So you just wrote down twice, right? That's all right. I was going to get you up here twice. So with that.
I think he gets twice as much time there.
Okay.
Right. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and here to support House Bill 2042. This is, and I'm going to characterize it as a very simple little bill. Very simple little bill. All it proposes to do is to give counties the same authority that cities have with regard to the use of utilities within the public right-of-way. All it proposes to do is to extend to counties the same authority that cities have for the location of utilities within the public right-of-way. The bill would allow counties to charge a fee to utilities for their facilities within the right-of-way of county roads outside city limits. Very simple. Currently, state statute allows the cities to charge fees. It precludes counties. So this is another one of those options that counties are looking to the legislature to provide to counties to, in some respects, and you'll hear about this, recoup some of the costs that we have with regard to coordination with utilities, and to provide some additional revenue to deal with some of our costs at this point. This proposal actually came out of the Governor's Task Force on Secure Rural Schools, and I assume that many of you have seen this final report. It is recommendation number 25 that is found on page 104 and 105 of the document at this point. So this concept has been talked for some time. It is a recommendation that comes forward from the Governor's Task Force. And again, as I've indicated, it's a very simple bill in that it gives counties the same authority, if you will, that cities have. And I would also note it's optional. There is nothing here that would require a county to establish fees as it relates for utilities. It is permissive. So a county would then have to enter into a process to either to establish franchises or to establish fees that utilities would be responsible to for at this point. The bill also has a little bit of fairness in it. It is our understanding that the city's utility fees are based on a service area, a large service area, or that can include land outside of the city limits. So there is the occasion, and again, this is our understanding, that people in unincorporated areas are currently paying for, let's say, franchise fees and the use of the utilities, but they're really not getting any service for the fees that they're paying in terms of being in an unincorporated portion of a county and actually paying for services that are and funds that are going into a city at this point. So there is a question of fairness here. So with that, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cam Gilmore. I'm director of Clackamas County's Department of Transportation and Development. I think my duty here this afternoon is just to give you a little bit of information about our road program and why it's important for us to recoup as many costs that are out there that we get nothing back for. You probably heard in previous testimony at previous hearings that the road fund that we rely almost exclusively on for road maintenance in Clackamas County, about 80% now with the Secure Rural School money coming back but going away in 3 years. We have to use those funds for just about everything we do on the county road system. In Clackamas County, that's about a 1,400-mile system. That's just going in one direction. Utilities often go one direction and the other direction, if not across the road. Every day, we're working with utility companies in a permitting function, allowing them to do the work they need to do to keep their operations functioning adequately, whether it's locating a new line in our right-of-way or cutting across a pavement and repairing it as they go about working on the other side of the road. On a daily basis, there's substantial costs involved with that. We probably have 400 or 500 permits annually anyway that we issue. Those permits are issued free of charge. They do require a bond that the utility company has to put up, but we get no compensation for the review of that permit, the inspections of the work done in our right-of-way by a utility company, and what have you. Well, with the declining road fund, the road fund actually now is declining, as you probably have heard. In Clackamas County, I want to say this year we're estimating it'll be down about $1 million this year relative to last year and the prior year due to lower gasoline sales. So anything that you can consider that will help us recoup costs that are probably legitimate to recoup, that we don't recoup today, would certainly be an aid to us in trying to keep our road system operating as safely and efficiently as possible. So we're here today to encourage you to take a close look at this bill. As Mr. Schlack said, it's something that the cities do have authority to do now. It does help them recoup some of their costs. Today, I think we have at least three FTE in the road department devoted to doing this work. Again, it's extensive. It's countywide. We have a large county, and we'd like to be on the same playing field as the cities in recouping those costs associated with permit issuance, inspecting, and whatnot with the utility companies. With that, I'll hand it off to Bill.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Bill Morgan. I'm the county engineer for Lane County, so an engineer gets to come up and speak. And I direct the staff of, used to be 40, and now we're diminished down in the last 3 years, 30%. So the need of further tightening the belt is out there, and the need to further look at other sources of revenue are out there. Thank you for hearing us today. First of all, we are not opposed to utilities being in the right-of-way. In fact, utilities should be in the right-of-way, and we work well with utilities all throughout the process, either from a daily maintenance standpoint or from a long-term capital improvement process or for just managing our day-to-day operations. In kind of in hindsight of this bill, or the free, what we're calling the free of charge, the current law was probably a good idea when the counties were rural, and maybe the incentive was to get the utilities out to the rural communities. But now, in looking at that, a lot of our roads are within urban growth boundaries. A lot of the utilities are already in place, and you can't really differentiate between a county road and a city road. You're still cutting the asphalt. You're still borrowing into the boring and cutting. Lane County also has a lot of costs with respect to the daily operations, direct and indirect costs, and I'll kind of go into those in a little bit. Lane County itself is the size of Connecticut. I don't know what the square footage is, but when I moved out here 5 years ago, they said the size of Connecticut, and it's like, wow, that is large. So in a day-to-day operation, let's say we get a facility permit that's out in Oak Ridge, we have to literally drive out there and look at. So there is a cost that's maybe not even an urban cost. It's a large portion to look at within the county. Over the past 6 years, we average, again, about 400 to 500 permits a year. And I was looking this morning at my desk, and I pulled out the typical permit application. And, again, we have utility permits. We have roadside logging permits, development, construction permits, driveway permits. Again, we have utility permits, but on the schedule of fees down on the bottom, we're currently not receiving any fees for this. So we view this as the same level of service that we must provide for the safety of our public, for the safety of our workers, in that we want to work with the utilities to make sure that their installation of utilities are safe, so that when our crews are out there, for instance, replacing a culvert during a flooding season, that we know where the utilities are. We work with them on the depth of bury and also the placement of the road right-of-way. So, again, the direct costs are within these 400 to 500 permits. The other costs that we sometimes have with utilities operating within our right-of-way are damage to pavement. And if you've ever driven across a new road and all of a sudden there's a utility trench, that's one of those things that, again, we try to avoid. But utilities need to be in the right-of-way. If they can't bore, then they need to place cuts. I talked to our pavement coordinators today, and I asked them, okay, what type of harm would a pavement cut give to a county road? And they say it decreases the usable life by up to 50%. So if you've ever driven around the areas that have extensive utility cuts, water starts draining into the subgrade. It creates potholes. So that's another reason why we need to work with the utility companies and have another funding mechanism. Also, again, we need to coordinate on a day-to-day basis with utilities on our operations and maintenance. And in fact, we're installing culverts, 50 culverts a year, maintaining those. And a lot of times what we want to avoid is utilities just plowing right through the culverts. So if there's not strong coordination, county crews will have to stop work, and then we'll have to lower utilities and such. In summary, providing a location within the right-of-way for utilities is sound business. And, again, what I'm here to testify is that it is a cost. For Lane County, about two full-time equivalent or about $150,000 a year is what we're expending now for utility coordination. Again, we've had the division I manage has had to cut 30% of our crews or our workforce, and this funding mechanism would allow us to keep this service for the safety and benefit of Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we were to do this, right now we have landlines that are starting to diminish. People are dropping their landlines, going to cell phones. And if you have like larger counties that implement this fee basis, what do you think that's going to do to the existing phone companies that are dealing with landlines? This could be something that puts them over the top and basically the inevitable is coming, but puts them out of business quicker.
Chair Byer, Representative Widener, my experience, at least with the cities and the utility fees, given the fact that you've got a large service area, we're talking about a relatively small, very small kind of fee that would go back to the individual consumer at this point. So we're not in the aggregate, it could be, you know, for a county, it could be several hundred thousand dollars, maybe. I don't know. We haven't looked at that, but the cost per individual would be extremely small. Extremely small.
Follow up? So, right now, I worry about the phone companies, or one part, and the electric bills. I mean, we're saying relatively small, but we're opening the door for counties to set whatever amount they want. So for your county, it might be relatively small, but we also have electric bills. We have lots of other bills. And I worry about these because they hurt the guy that's making $40,000 a year with his two kids, and his electric bill's already approaching $150, $200 a month. And if this puts it to $220, you know, that's a big burden on people of low income. And I think it's something we need to be careful of, opening the door to where cities, counties, and now the state, you got three different places doing it. And I bet if we did a breakdown on telephone bills, because I know all the taxes and fees aren't in the telephone bill, and I dropped my landline just because of this. And we're going to be doing a lot of damage to a lot of poor people out there. And I'm just wondering if you guys took that into consideration when you thought of supporting this bill.
Chair Byer, Representative Widener, I would say we have taken it into consideration, but as you've heard here, the cost to at least counties to provide for the coordination so that everybody can basically have utilities and they function well and we have a safe and efficient road system, there are costs at both levels at this point. And unfortunately, the counties at this point are, because we don't have a mechanism to recoup some of our costs, at this point, we're taking funds away from being able to do the maintenance and preservation of the system so that we can do the coordination. So there's a question about, I guess, again, in terms of fairness, that the users of the system should help pay the costs. And what counties are asking for here is the opportunity to have the users of the system being the utility system, help bear some of the costs of having their facilities within the right-of-way, which I would just submit at this point would be a much more revenue neutral than it would be if we didn't have utilities in the right-of-way and the utilities had to, get easements on private property to locate those utilities outside of the public right-of-way, and then we wouldn't have the costs that we're speaking of at this point.
Thank you.
More quick follow-up?
Okay, sure.
I guess I would feel a lot better about this. I mean, because you're talking about your full-time employees, you have two, you have three. I would probably feel better if you were coming before us asking us about our full-time employees, because we have FTEs of 1,000 and we're only filling 850 positions. to me, you should be coming here and asking us where the money's going, and we should be tracking that, because that's money that you're losing directly, and nobody seems to be able to get a handle on it. So we're saying we're employing 1,000 and we only have 850 in positions that are filled. I think that's something the county should be, what's going on at the state, to find increased revenue for you. Does that make sense? What, where the waste is going at the state level of dollars. So, because that's money that's being taken away from the counties.
Maybe, I think we all might, except for it's running late, maybe we'll have to clarify what numbers you're referring to. So, and with that, I have Representative Schaffler, and I did want to say this will be it today. So, you guys, all those waiting can come back, and we'll take care of you early on Wednesday.
Thank you. I think, I'm not sure, but I think primarily we're talking about unincorporated, urbanized county when we're talking about this stuff. And I'm not pointing any fingers or blaming anybody. The problem is, historically, some mistakes have been made in urbanizing unincorporated Oregon. And I if you went door to door, and I have, in large parts of unincorporated Clackamas County, I didn't ask them this question, but if you did ask them, do you want franchise fees to be applied over your utilities that are in the right of way? We all know the answer to that question. That's why they're not incorporated. And there have been efforts, and you are well as well aware of them, if not more aware of them than I am, to incorporate those folks. And I am very reluctant to just say, okay, go ahead and do it to them now, even though they refuse, do not want, or have nor desire, any desire, to be in incorporated Oregon. It's once again, and I think you're right, Art, it's people that are using these facilities and aren't paying the same as I am in incorporated Oregon. It's a mathematical equation you cannot refute. But we're kind of stuck here now, aren't we? And I think it was because of some bad decisions made in the past. I'm not so sure we're going to fix those decisions with this bill, but I just wanted to share my outlook on it.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your coming, and I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing, and we'll carry it over till Wednesday.